Welcome back to another episode of Exposing Ourselves. I'm Travis Ritchie, and this is episode 61. This is the show where we expose each other to new things. Matt, a big music fan, will assign me one of his favorite music artists to listen to each week, and I, a movie buff, will give him one of my favorite films, and we come together on this very podcast to discuss it all. And with me, as always, is my very good friend,
Matt Rundquist. Hey, Travis, how you doing? This week, I watched the movie Room, not The Room. Room, and you listen to Melanie Martinez.
Yes, there's an important distinction between Room and The Room.
Although, for sure, you know, for sure.
Have you seen The Room? I asked you that last week.
No.
You said no, right?
I'm not surprised you didn't listen to my answer, because...
You know what? That might have been a good contrast to this movie, because we are going to need something lighter this week, I think.
I think so. This one was a little heavy, but we'll get into that a little bit later. Hey, Travis, I always go first when we talk about what we did this week. Why don't you lead the way?
All right, I will. Twist my arm. This week was a fun week. It was worky, you know, lots of work, but it started out with a really interesting experience. So I have been working on the talk for about 2.5 years as my kind of day job. And what I do is I do stand-in work, which is I don't know if I've ever really explained this on the show before, but when a lot of people ask, what's a stand-in? And when you think about actors on movie sets, before they actually roll cameras and capture performances, they have to set up lights and set up camera angles and stuff like that. And they don't generally use the actor in those moments because, you know, they're not going to just be there doing nothing. So they hire a person to stand in for the actor. And that's what I do. And so it's a very fun job. We get to do everything that the hosts do. So we play the games that they're going to play. We read through the scripts that they're going to read through sometimes. And I essentially get to do everything that a host does on a talk show, except be on camera, you know? So, but this Monday, they had a sketch on the show for I think the NCIS guests that were showing up were going to play a game. And they needed two actors. Two quote-unquote paid actors. The setup was kind of a dating game type thing where they had three people behind a curtain, or in this case, silhouetted, and they asked them questions, and one of them was an NCIS super fan, and the other two were paid actors, and the guests had to figure out who was who.
Okay.
It wasn't tough, because the way it was, we were kind of purposefully giving wrong answers, but it was great, and I got to be paid a good amount of money for what was essentially an hour of work, and it's probably the most I've ever been paid for the least amount of work.
Yeah,
so that was fun.
I think
that definitely...
doesn't every actor have a story like that where it's like, I won an Oscar in an indie film making like at scale, right? But then I also made $20 million phoning it in a, you know.
Sure.
In a movie tie-in type thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah, there are definitely, especially like big actors do a lot of that. And so like, you know, Bruce Willis will, you know, do 15 minutes of work and get paid $1 million for it or whatever, or used to before he retired.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that the rest of the week, I believe, was pretty much work at the Apple store and also, you know, every day at the talk in the morning. So I'm a little bit sleep deprived. I did sleep in this morning for the first time all week, which was nice.
Ooh, nice.
Otherwise, I've been doing like 4 or 5 hours a night, which is not enough for me.
That's not enough for almost anyone. There's some people that apparently have like a thing in their brain that allows them to fully recover after 4 or 5 hours. It's something like 3 or 4% of the population can just... function on an abnormally low amount of sleep and have no problem with it. But I am also not one of those people.
Right. No, I hear you. I have been working on my napping. And so there's research out that says like short naps, 20 to 30 minutes, are actually refreshing and really good for you. But longer than that, and you get that really oogie feeling where you just have a hard time breaking out of that. Yeah. So you have to get yourself before you fall too deeply asleep.
Oh.
And so I've been working on that.
Do you set an alarm?
I do. Yeah. I have an alarm like on my chest, like my phone on my chest. And, but it works really well. And that, you know, research on that dates back to like Thomas Edison and, you know, really smart people who used to just practice short napping. But the other big news for me this week is I last night went on a first date that was really spectacular. I'm not going to tell you too much about it on the show. I talked to you a little bit about it before we started rolling. But it was a great first date. And it's notable because I don't generally go on first dates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not first dates. It's not like I skip to the second date or whatever. Excuse me. I don't do first dates.
Yeah, so. you just show up and you're like, you know what? Five. Let's skip to date two. Let's go.
Yes. No. It's just that my previous relationships have generally, and this is maybe indicative of being gay or queer, they tend to start sexually and then move mm-hmm. from there. And this is probably maybe too much information for some of our listeners. But yeah, that's just how my world has been different.
Yeah.
And but this was a really classic first date, like dinner.
That's awesome.
A long walk, literally a long walk on the beach.
Oh, holy my
cow.
Gosh.
We went to I didn't even make that connection. We went to Santa Monica and just kind of walked along the beach.
That's the kind of thing you can do. That's the kind of thing you can do in LA.
Yep, it is. Yep. And so it was great. And hopefully I'll be able to tell you more about this guy in the future.
Excellent. Looking forward to
it. So how about you? How was your week?
It was a pretty good week. Rosa, my dog, is doing quite a bit better after her little incident last week. Her swelling is down.
Good.
Her affect is up. All that's good. She still does have stitches.
Her what is up?
Affect. Like her she's, you know, excitable and acting normal
okay,
self.
Okay, got it. Okay, yeah. Got it.
She's running around the yard and all that good stuff. She does still have Frankenstein stitches in the top of her head, so it's a little jarring, but not nearly like it was when her face was all swollen. She kind of looked like a Shar Pei head on a greyhound body. So yeah. that was a little disturbing. Other than that, three quarters of the new tea service band got together last week and played together, and it was, dare I say it, good. It was fun, and we were able to work out some songs, and we each actually brought some songs that we had written, and we were able to, you know, make them ours as a group rather than this person's song or that person's song. It was really, really cool and refreshing, and I'm hopeful we're going to have our first practice with our bassist in early May. She's pretty busy right now, as are we all. And so that will happen in early May, and then I'm hopeful we're going to maybe start booking some gigs for the fall so we have something to look forward to.
That is so cool, Matt. Yeah. I am so happy for you. I love collaborative creativity.
Yeah, so do I. It's the best. Playing with other people is the best. Like, it's all very well and good to sit and write songs in the basement, and I enjoy that, but the sheer, like, community of coming together as a group and playing music together is hopefully something that I'll never lose. I really, really dig it. Also, I don't know if you know this, but Panko Stankhole made it into a press release this week, so I was pretty excited to see that. You had mentioned a couple of weeks ago that you had hired a PR person to try to drum up a little bit of business for you, and your podcast, this podcast that we're on right now, got mentioned, as did my not exactly defunct, but not super active project, Panko Stankhole.
You've got an album out there.
I got an album out there, and yeah, you never know where the next hit is going to come from. So I appreciate your including me in that. That was nice.
Nice. Now, I don't think I sent that to you, did I? You
posted
Google
it on your social media, and I read it there. Yeah.
I thought maybe you had a Google alert for Panko Stankhole.
I do not have a Google alert for
which
Panko
I do. I have Google alerts for myself and also Inspector Spacetime,
yeah,
which these days is mostly bringing back links to the Icelandic band named Inspector Spacetime.
I did not know about that. I can't believe you've never mentioned that on the show.
That's funny. Maybe.
Do they make good music?
It's not bad, and okay, perhaps for our extra very special episode, I'll give you them.
100th episode.
And we'll listen to one of their albums. But yeah, no, I like it. It's not maybe my type of music. It's It's very like electropunk, European.
Ooh, I dig that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think maybe you might like it. I think
I'm going to have a hard time resisting the urge to look it up before the 100th episode, but I will. Yes. I will resist because I want to give you. I want to give you some.
All right. Well, let's get there as soon as possible.
Let's get there.
We do that by getting to the meat.
Let's get to the meat. Let's switch things up this week and listen to the music first. What do you think?
All right. Tell me about Melanie Martinez, the most famous person I'd never heard of.
Really? Yeah, that's an interesting way to put that. She is actually pretty popular. She's a female pop artist. She first came to everyone's attention on The Voice in 2012. She did pretty well on there, although I think it was like sixth or something. It wasn't like she was top two or anything like that. But on the basis of her work there, she got a record deal. She recorded her first album. It's called Crybaby. It came out in 2015. And I really like it. It's a very cohesive piece of work. Like, it works as an album, which is always something that I appreciate. Probably just from, you know, I came up in the prime time for album-oriented rock in the 80s. And then, of course, in the 90s with alternative and grunge, albums were still very much a focus rather than necessarily singles. And so I always like it when a modern artist in this world where we're all about the TikToks and the streams on YouTube, the artist puts together a full album as a cohesive whole. And I really dig it. It's very upbeat, but there's maybe some darker subject matter, often revolving around family, I would say, more than relationships, which is kind of – that's a little different too. Like, so many of these artists are all about, this is a bad relationship I had. This is a bad relationship. Mm-hmm. This is a toxic relationship dynamic. And a lot of the things that are mentioned on this album are, you know, bad relationships, but they're bad familial relationships rather than romantic ones. So I don't know if I necessarily have a favorite song on this album that I could point to. I love the opening track, Crybaby, but there's lots of good stuff here. What'd you think, Travis?
Well, so I will say right off the bat that I loved also the cohesiveness of the album. The theme of the album is maybe the best we've seen yet. There's this, so she uses the theme of childhood and childhood toys, childhood interactions, emotions to frame a lot of these songs that you were talking about, and a lot of these subject matter of relationships with family and stuff like that. And so I really, really appreciated the writing of the album, and that was maybe my favorite thing. It was, I will tell you that it was better the second time through, but I almost didn't give it a second listen.
Really?
Because the first time through, this is, you said this is a little bit of a dark album. I think this is a very dark album. I think the emotions and that are expressed are there's a lot of anger and a lot of angst and a lot of darkness in this album. And that doesn't really vibe for me a lot of times. And in fact, while I was hiking, listening to it the first time through, I found myself getting angry and like clenching my teeth and you know, listening to it. And I didn't enjoy that experience.
Sorry, not to cut in or anything, but I...
Go ahead.
It's interesting that you had that emotional reaction to it, because oftentimes when I watch movies that you really like, I have that sort of reaction, like, this is good, but also I feel terrible right now, and I don't, and I wonder why I have more tolerance for that when it's musical than movie. But
interesting,
what you
I have
just
had that
described,
same thought in reverse.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, what you just described is exactly how I feel about some of the movies, that, like The Impossible, for instance, right? Great movie, and I have a hard time saying, you know, anything bad about it, but also, boy, do I not want to watch this, right?
So
I get it. So you did listen to it a second time.
Yes, and I will say it somehow, I don't know what changed. Oh, I will, before I get to the second listen, I do want to say also there was a very interesting experience wherein my brain had to adjust a little bit to the listening of this album, almost like watching a movie with people who speak in accents, mm-hmm. or moving somewhere and having to adjust to a different language almost. Because when I started listening to it, the way her vocals are produced was very off-putting for me, mm-hmm. in a way that was like, I can't remember. I don't know if it was like, if it was a processing of her vocals or a way that they were like, I don't know, just like, if it was just her voice, I don't really know. But it was, by the end of the album, by the end of that first listen, I was used to it, and that feeling had disappeared. And so I wanted to know if, so I immediately started it back up again, just to listen to the first song, just to see if I had that same, like, I was like, wow, did my brain change?
Uh-huh.
Or did the music change?
Uh-huh.
And it turns out it was my brain. Because I went back to the first album and or the first song, and it sounded normal. It sounded like the rest of the, you know, the last song, which
That's
I really liked, by the way.
Fascinating.
I thought the album ended very well, which is a big thing for us, right?
Mm-hmm.
We like a good beginning, and we like a good ending. And I think that this does that, assuming you like this performance, the Melanie Martinez herself, then I think your experience listening to this album is going to be fantastic. So, okay. Darkness. I did find that the darkness that I experienced listening to it the first time through was abated a bit the second time through, and I don't know if it was, again, my brain kind of adjusting to it, mm-hmm. or it was kind of a gloomy day here. And
really?
It fit the day a little bit.
Yeah. You know, honestly, it was a little gloomy here yesterday when I was listening to the album a second time. And it does – it's funny because so much of the imagery – so I have this album on vinyl, and a lot of the imagery is very bright. And, you know, you can see the cover of the album on the playlist. You can see it's pink, and there's, like, bright Mylar balloons, and it's
– yeah.
It's styled as if it was like a child or a child's room.
Yeah.
And that's consistent through the whole, you know, the whole booklet for the album. There's like blocks and pastels, and it's very fluffy, right? And which is, of course, mm-hmm. a huge contrast to the subject matter. I thought that was interesting and an interesting way to go. And I do think, yeah, one does get sort of inured a little bit to the darkness of it as well.
Ooh, that's an interesting word to use, and I think that you're kind of right. So okay, let me talk about something I didn't like.
Sure.
The swears.
There are a lot of swears.
Like half these songs, yeah, are E for what? E
explicit.
For explicit. What is E?
E explicit. Is explicit.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I was like, E for everyone is what games are. I was like, that's not right. You know how I feel about unnecessary swears, and it's funny. I was thinking about this in connection with my roommate who wants to be a stand-up comedian, and he swears a lot in his routine, and just in regular life. And I told him the other day, I was like, it makes you sound less intelligent when you resort to the F-bomb rather than thinking of a different way to express yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that too with this music. I feel like, especially as well written as the rest of the songs are,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of a shame that she felt such a need to swear so much. And maybe that's a young person thing, or maybe it's a, I don't know, a first album insecurity thing or what, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it is, and maybe it's just me being an old man being like, stop swearing so much, you kids.
I mean, but I think all of the above, right? Like, it's funny, Taylor Swift on her latest album before the one that came out today on the day that we are taping this, which I have not listened to yet. That previous album had a swear on either every track or all tracks bar one, which is a little unusual for her, you know, and it's maybe just a little bit of a growing up thing and feeling like, I've got my power and I can swear if I want to. But
perhaps purposefully shattering her image in her case.
Yeah, shattering the image for sure. But you know, it is. I would say I wouldn't put a value judgment on it like you do, right? It is what it is. Some people can express themselves really wonderfully without swears. Some people swear all the time. And some people don't swear all the time so that when they do, it's more effective, just like we were talking about earlier, you know? So mm-hmm. I don't know. But I do get that that is not a thing that you dig. And I did – when I was listening to this, I was like, oh, there is a lot of swearing in this. I'll bet you Travis isn't going to like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say, though – that I do want to touch back on the songwriting and how each song was very distinct and really imaginative on how it uses the imagery of childhood to provide a metaphor for other things. Like, you know, there's a song that goes into the idea of a Mr. Potato Head doll and a Mrs. Potato Head doll being able to change their face and like. You know, and it kind of connects with plastic surgery and like the need to change yourself in order to offer a perceived beauty to the world.
Right.
And I really liked that. Like, we talk about writing a lot and we talked about poetry a lot on the show. And I think that this album has a lot of that mm-hmm. in a very powerful way. I would have liked to see just a little more brightness, a little more contrast. There are a couple of songs that are a little bit bouncy, but even with the bouncy music, you're getting very dark themes, and I just had a lot of that.
Yeah. That's fair. That
makes
sense. Hey, talk a little bit about, so you said you found out this week that Melanie Martinez is a very famous artist. Talk to me about that.
Well, just looking, so one of the things I like to do when you assign an album is I like to go through and look at their biggest songs, right? And her biggest songs are all on this album, so we listened to them. But, I mean, geez, I'm looking at this going, like if I go to artist, her... I'm seeing 597 million views on Dollhouse, 838 million views on or million plays on Playdate, like hundreds of millions of views on all these songs, and I had never heard of this person, and I think that's extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I for sure. I didn't know also sometimes you talk to your coworkers, and so I thought this might be another Phoenix situation where you mention it.
It wasn't.
Like, you've never heard of
it. I did talk to my coworkers about it. Yeah, so my coworkers are about 10, 13 years younger than me, uh-huh. and so oftentimes I use them as a barometer for, you know, how much should I know about someone. And so Christina, in particular, said that she wasn't aware of Melanie Martinez, but we listened to some of her music, and her take was that Melanie had a big K-pop influence.
Oh, sure.
Which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I would say both from an aesthetic standpoint and the actual music. There's definitely a strong thread of that running through it.
Yeah.
For sure.
For me, I was picking up a lot of Billie Eilish energy.
Yeah,
and I only really know Billie Eilish because she's been heavy in the songs for movies world, and she just won best song this year at the Oscars.
Yeah, that's her second Oscar, right?
Is it her second one?
I think it's her second one. Yeah.
Did she win for her James Bond song?
I think so. Yeah.
Sounds about right. It was a good song, and she also is known for good writing. Which is her collaboration with her brother, is that right?
Yeah, her brother does all of the music, and then she does all the writing. I think it's mostly written just by her, but it might be
interesting.
It might be with him. I'm not in the bedroom. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm also picking up echoes of Susie and the Banshees, which is someone I've mentioned before. I think about a year ago, probably on this podcast. I don't remember who in connection with, but the that dark kind of like. Poppy driving music that they did for my experience as part of the Batman Returns soundtrack.
Oh, sure.
And that was how I connected with them. But I was like, oh, yeah, Susie and the Banshees walked so that Melanie Martinez could run. And but I made that connection a little bit.
I mean, there's a lot of connections in pop music, right? Because it's all it's all a giant edifice that sort of, you know, steals from itself and creates new things out of it. And, you know, it's hard to know where one thing
all art, probably.
Yeah, all art, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Anything else you want to touch on? I feel like we've covered this pretty well.
Yeah. No. This is. It is interesting that my. I always kind of have ratings in the back of my head, like kind of like, oh, what am I gonna rate this? And I will say it changed a lot.
Interesting.
It like started, fell, rose, fell again.
Sure.
So. Yeah, I don't know yet, even though you're about Ooh. To ask the question.
Oh, well, in that case, yet, that sounds like it. My cue. Travis, what do you rate this?
Ah, gosh, now I actually have to make a decision.
Yeah.
So I was at one point pretty down on this music, mainly because of the kind of anger and darkness that we mentioned that I really don't care for. And mm-hmm. and I will say that this is music that I ultimately probably don't care for
okay.
and won't listen to again. But I do want to give appropriate respect and acknowledgement to the skill and artistry of this songwriting. Like, I really love the storytelling
okay.
of this album.
Yeah.
And so that's going to give it a bit. But then, you know, the unnecessary swears probably take off a bit for me. Yeah. So, like, I think I'm going to settle on a 4 for me.
4. A little bit below average.
A little bit below average.
But I didn't hate it.
And that is reflecting that is heavily weighted by my personal preference, right? So
okay.
mostly that versus the skill of the song. Like, there are – okay. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
How about you?
Well, I like this a lot. I don't love it, right? It's really good music. It's something that I can throw on and know that I'm going to enjoy the whole album. I'm not going to have to skip anything. But I don't throw it on that much. I was thinking about a 6, but I do really like the swears, so I think I'm going to give it a 7.
Yeah, and you know what? There is a song called Soap that I found interesting, too, where they used the sound of soap bubbles as music, which I found...
Ooh, that actually, there's one other comment that I have about the album, which is that there's a lot of, like, interesting sounds on this album. It's not it's not just, like, guitar, bass, drums, keyboard, right? There's lots of really cool sounds and interesting percussion choices or interesting... you know, bubbles or whatever types of things. Nice production adds that really add to the whole experience. So,
yep, absolutely. And also, I mean, for it being a 2015 album, you said?
Yeah. Yes.
That's pretty interesting. I like that. It feels almost experimental for the time.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, Travis, tell me about Room.
Well, Room is a 2015 movie also, which is just one of a couple of interesting connections between this movie and our song choice. I feel like there is also a lot of darkness in this movie. And it is a survival drama, psychological drama. It was written by a woman by the name of Emma Donahue, based on her novel of the same name from only 5 years earlier. And it stars Brie Larson as a young woman who was abducted when she was 17 and spends 7 years locked in a room, in a tool shed, essentially, that's been converted into essentially a prison for her. And she is... I guess we should have had a trigger warning that this album might include references to sexual abuse, but she is sexually abused continuously during this time by her captor. And the result of one of those instances is her getting pregnant and having a baby.
Yeah.
And so this boy named Jack is raised. He's 5 years old when we meet them, and he has spent his entire life in what they call room. Like, they name room kind of a first-person name, right? Yeah. And everything in the room is also kind of a first-person, like, hello, sink, hello, closet, hello, rug.
Yeah.
And they have a TV, and she frames the outside world for him so that he can survive. She frames the world as only existing in room, mm-hmm. and everything outside is just there is nothing outside. It's just outer space, and then the things they see on TV are only exist on TV.
Right,
and it's very powerful. Their performances in the room are amazing, and I watched this back when it was on the award circuit, so back in like 2015, and it was I didn't remember that. They escape the room about halfway through. Mm-hmm. Like, I, even watching it, kind of assumed that the climax of the movie was going to be the escape attempt. Mm-hmm. Instead, that happens about halfway through the movie in a harrowing sequence of scenes where my heart was pounding more than it... I mean, than I remember it doing
more than
almost
safe
any
for
other
a man of your age.
Well, but more than watching any other movie that I can think of. Like, the experience of watching this was extraordinary because I had that experience during the escape. But then the rest of the movie, I spent basically crying for half the movie because the exploration of both a child who has never experienced anything else of the world outside of one single room, combined with a young woman who almost half of her life has been spent, not half of her life, but like 7 years out of 24 has been spent in prison. Mm-hmm. And all the feelings that that causes about the things you've missed and the way your life has been disrupted. And of course, the abuse that she endured. Was just extraordinary. It's an extraordinary film, and the performances are excellent in my view. So I loved it. I loved re-experiencing it, and also kind of remembering all the things that go on. And so I'm expecting you're going to react to the darkness in this movie the way I reacted to the darkness in the music, in probably not a great way, but. I'm very curious to hear, Matt, what did you think of Room?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree that not a great way, right? This one did not weigh on me as heavily as The Impossible for whatever reason.
Really?
But it is everything that you've said about it is true. It's wonderfully acted. It's very well written. It is an interesting exploration of their time both inside and outside. It's interesting because when you described this to me last week, I actually had the impression that they escaped relatively early into the movie. And so for whatever reason, once we got past the 15-minute mark and they weren't out yet, I was like, oh, gosh, how long is it going to be? But I agree with you. Those scenes around the escape are some of the most terrifying and affecting cinema I've ever seen in my life. They are really, really phenomenal. And, you know, you say, oh, that's going to be the climax of the movie. Yeah, I mean, it is the that is the climax of the movie.
It could have been.
That is the high emotional point of the movie. There's half of this movie is denouement. And that's fine because I think that's a literary choice to say everything after this hyper intense moment is going to feel different and you're changed and this is what life is like after that change. But that is like that's the dictionary definition of a climax is like that's the point. It's interesting too because I thought that might fail, right? Because she makes a plan and then that plan does not work. Right. And so then this is the second plan and you're very much primed for this also to not work. And so when it does and then there's a moment when it looks like maybe the captor is going to successfully get the kid back to the room. It's terrifying when the kid finally, when it's clear that the kid has finally escaped. I bawled like a baby. I didn't bawl for the rest of the movie, but I definitely bawled like a baby for that section of it. And then there's a few minutes of this movie where it's not clear that she is still alive, right? Because right. You easily can imagine him going back to the shed and killing her.
Right.
Instead, he apparently runs, right, and then is caught. And that's dealt with all – like, I'm glad that the movie does not focus on him at all. He is an accessory right. to this story of
– In many ways, they deal with that, with shoving him aside. And she didn't expect to live, actually. She
– Right.
She makes it kind of clear – I mean, not through script or words, but, like, through acting and performance, I guess.
Yeah.
That she just was doing this to get him out. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Or at the very least – if he was able to get her out, that was like a bonus, but that was mm-hmm. not why. Which is interesting because then there is that interview scene later in the movie where they're talking to her and asking her, well, why didn't you get him out earlier, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's obviously armchair quarterbacking and it's awful and it shows us how by their nature these types of interviews are exploitative. And folks, if you watch television, please avoid things like that because the only way mm-hmm. that they're going to go away is if they don't get ratings because they're not good. They're bad. They're bad for the victims and it's not okay. So all that said, Brie Larson's fantastic. I will say another thing that popped up for me is just, boy, Travis really loves a great child actor performance. Like, this is a great child actor performance, and it's probably the fourth or fifth one you've given me that it's just like, wow, this kid is really so – both in it – and he does, like – does he do voiceovers? Is that
– Yeah, he was in –
He does
he
a bunch of voice –
Little Mermaid.
No, I mean, like, in this movie, right? There's a bunch of voiceover.
Oh, in this movie, yeah.
Yeah, there's a bunch of voiceover narration, yeah. And so both in that and in his actual acting, really, really good. Really good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how, speaking of child actors, his name is Jacob Tremblay. And he has become he's gone on to do other things and been fairly successful. But in this movie in particular, there is not a wrong note in his performance.
Yeah.
And I found myself thinking a lot about how you get that performance from a child as young as he was 7 when they shot this, mm-hmm. playing a 5-year-old. But it's fascinating to think about, like, it's so easy for a child actor to be cloying, right? Mm-hmm. And you think of say, the young Anakin Skywalker mm-hmm. in Star
Jake
Wars,
Lloyd.
Right? Jake Lloyd. He has gotten a lot of flack for that performance. And I don't blame him for that performance. I blame George Lucas entirely. And I think that in this case, there were probably instances where they were working on one line to get one line right mm-hmm. at a time.
Yeah.
And, you know, but the way that they shot it, building the room on a soundstage and having minimal interaction between Jacob and other people so that he had a really strong connection with Brie Larson. I don't know, man. That shone through so well. And Brie Larson ended up winning Best Actress mm-hmm. at the Oscars as well as a bunch of other international awards. This was an international production, so it was nominated for Canadian awards and won a bunch of those. In fact, I think Jacob Tremblay won Best Actor for the Canadian version of the Oscars.
Okay.
And the British version of the Oscars, the British awards were well represented for this movie, too.
Yeah, I think the Oscars are just kind of gun-shy about child actors ever since Anna Paquin, I think. She's really kind of the only one that has ever really won one of the headline
Oscars.
Yeah,
Anna Paquin
right?
won for The Piano, and then before that it was, I can't remember what her name was, but it was a long time. It was like the 70s.
Yeah, right.
Anyway.
Yeah. So it's interesting that he got a Best Actor award in Canada. So that's all the good stuff, right? This is a very, very heavy movie. And there are definitely times when it was over that I'm like, so the point of this movie is that it's really bad to get kidnapped and held hostage and raped, right? And like, not to be dismissive about that, right? But there's like, the story is, man, this really sucks, right? And you know, if that's enough story for you, then great. But like, I don't know how much I think that message is like, I don't know. There's just times when I'm like, well, this isn't entertaining to me, right? Because I'm not entertained by these depictions, right? And you know, so is there like a message or something that I can learn from this movie? And I don't feel like there's anything that I can learn from this movie either, right? It you know, not that you have to learn something from a movie, but like there has to be something for you to latch onto and be like, oh yeah, I like this, right? And I'm like, why did we make this movie, right?
I think, well, for me, it's the addition of the boy that makes it so fascinating of an experience. And I think this movie is an experience movie, right? The filmmakers are doing their best to put you in the shoes of this person and give you this experience that you probably will never have, thankfully, right? And so, and I think that's what a lot of good dramas do. And in this case, the addition of the child and the dichotomy of this place, this room, being a prison for one of them and the entire world for the other of them, mm-hmm. I think really comes to a head at the end when he asks to go back to room.
Yeah.
And what a fascinating moment.
Yeah.
For him, it's a revisiting of this friend, right? This thing that meant everything to him. And for her, it's going back to this source of ultimate trauma.
Yeah.
And I loved that moment where both of them were saying goodbye for completely different reasons.
Sure.
And it was so powerful for me. I loved it, and I thought, that kind of filmmaking was brilliant. I do want to mention, by the way, her parents are played by Joan Allen and William H. Macy, who are delightful always. And
didn't they play together in Pleasantville? Wasn't that also Joan Allen and William H. Macy?
Oh my gosh! Yes, it was.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's where I fell in love with Joan Allen.
Yeah. Oh, she's didn't amazing. We all? Didn't we all?
Yeah, she's so great.
One other thing that I wanted to point out in this movie that I did really like was the contrast in Ma's character from when she is in room and when she is not in room. Because in room, mm-hmm. her total focus is on him and raising him and making sure that he's not that he becomes a full human being, even though his world is very limited. And so she's totally focused on exercising him and getting him the nutrition that he needs and educating him and giving him the tools to understand the world, assuming that he never gets out, right? Mm-hmm. That he's still going to be able to have a full life somehow in this place. And she is fantastic, right? And it's almost like a dream of what a mother can be, right? But you believe it because she's doing it for him. And then when she gets out, all of a sudden she's left without that total responsibility anymore.
Yeah.
And she knows that he'll be able to move into the world as a more like normal kid. And she is suddenly a little bit left adrift as a mother. Like, what is my role as a mother now that I'm not the only thing that he's ever going to see and experience? Yeah. And that, I think, that transition is really good, and the way that it's handled in the movie is pretty good. I maybe – there's a few times when they do that thing where something happens off camera and then we see the results of it. It's a thing that The Crown always does that I just absolutely hated, and it's why I stopped watching after season three of The Crown. It's like something like really important would happen off camera, and then we just see these like brooding shots of people talking about the thing that happened.
Refresh my memory. Like what?
Diana sleeping with the – apparently Diana was supposedly sleeping with her horse people, like grooms and stuff.
No, I meant in this movie.
Oh, in this? Oh. Well, like, so the transition into depression for her is a little bit, like, abrupt, right? And you do get the feeling that, like, some things have happened where – because when she first gets out, she's actually kind of still in that, like, momming mode, right? And then all of a sudden there's, like, this – suicide attempt, and you like kind of get the suicide attempt, but also it's a little, it does feel like it's kind of out of nowhere a little bit. And there were just a few things that that I felt like there were times when I'm like, oh, I wish that that thing that they're talking about right now had just been on camera, you know. But I don't know that I can point out a ton of them, so.
Got it. There was something that sparked in my mind about the Jack's first interaction with a dog.
Yeah, that was really
like
nice.
That moment, because the Joan Allen character, Joy, is the mom, her mom and dad divorced while she was captured captive, and so her mom has a new husband. And the husband has a dog.
Yeah.
And so they originally, as soon as they know that the Jack and Joy are coming back, they send the dog away to a friend because they don't want too much
newness.
Anything.
Yeah.
In the house. And so, but at some point they bring the dog back, and Jack has always wanted a dog. And the, oh God, it was just another one of those moments where I was crying, and there was so much of that for me in this movie in the second half. So definitely have tissues ready if you're going to experience.
Yeah, honestly, like part of why I didn't love this movie was just because it's very emotionally intense, right? And it, like, for better or for worse, right? That is
interesting.
That's what they're trying to do, right? So I can't really fault them for that. But also, like, I don't know how much I love something that's this emotionally intense.
That's interesting. I do appreciate an emotional I love being moved some way in a movie. And if it's happy or sad, I think I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I certainly didn't hate it, but I think I maybe didn't love it as much as I might have expected, if that makes sense.
Okay, well, go ahead and go and quantify that for me. What do you rate The Room?
Quantify,
what do you rate
that?
Room?
Yeah, different question. I think that this is an 8 for me. I like it a lot. I doubt I would ever watch it again because it's kind of – I think a big part of the experience is like seeing what happens, right? And now I know this is your second time watching it, but it was far enough ago that you had mostly forgotten it.
Yeah.
But to me, yeah, it's an 8.
Good. I like that. And I think for me it's a 10. Just again – much like The Impossible, I think this movie plays on every note just right, and even the filming of it, you can tell that when they're in Room, the camera, even though I know that Room was a set and you could take the walls apart to shoot inside easier, I know that they always put the lens inside Room. And so it felt that way. So I really appreciated that.
I was going to say to maybe try to nick it a little bit for you is,
sure,
I think the reason that you couldn't remember, like, you, what when you were describing this, you were like, oh, I remember the escape being the climax and not much happening afterward, is because kind of not much does happen afterwards. And so it's easy to forget that after that sort of emotionally intense intensity of the escape, I think it's easy for your brain to kind of edit out a lot of the things that happen afterwards.
So. You're absolutely right. And this could easily be a movie that's an escape movie, mm-hmm. right? And that the actual and I think there's a difference between story writing wise between a midpoint and a climax. We won't quibble on that. But I think the climax could be them escaping and then coming into the world and then at the end. Mm-hmm. But I think the way they did it, the story that ended up being told about them being out and was so important to mm-hmm. the story and done so well. I'm very glad that it was a part of it. And I'm glad that I experienced
it. Okay, but then why is it that you think that you forgot that it existed? That part of the movie.
I think you're right because the midpoint is so emotionally intense, and also you know it was 9 years ago, you are right. It doesn't have a structure that is similar to most movies.
Yeah,
and so in that way, I think it was fairly
It's really good writing. It is really good writing.
Written by the woman who wrote the book, so that was kind of nice. And I will say, just real quick, it only made $36 million on a $13 million budget. But it was a co-production of four countries: Canada, Ireland, the UK, and the United States. Also, interesting to see an early credit for A24 as a studio.
Yeah.
Like we've seen a bunch of their stuff that we've loved, and I think that I think they only distributed it in the United States, mm-hmm. but it was fairly interesting to see that.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that name a lot in the last year and a half.
They're making big names. They're making big waves these days.
All right.
So, Matt, what do you have for me for next week?
Well, next week, have you ever heard of the Black Keys?
I honestly can't say if I have or haven't, for sure.
All right.
Because it sounds the vaguest familiar, but I don't know for
sure. This is another one that is very, very popular. You'll find they have tens of millions of views. The Black Keys, I'm not going to give you a whole lot on them, but they're a duo. They perform a very, like, garage rocky, blues-inflected rock sound, and I really like them. I've never been like the hugest fan of them, but this week I put together a playlist for you. They have a bunch of really good albums, and I couldn't choose a particular one. So you get sort of the high points of their career this week. That's all I got to tell you about them. They're garage rock, blues rock.
All right. I'm looking forward to experiencing that. I guess I have a question for you. Do you feel like contrasting Room with watching The Room?
Oh man, you gotta assign the movies. I can't assign the movies. Yeah. It's up to you. If you want to subject me to that, you can
do that. Well, so here's my dilemma. When I assign you The Room, it's going to be a double feature.
Oh god.
So
I will tell you, I am very busy this week, so you might need to.
Okay, so let's go ahead and skip it. And I will say there's a movie that's been on my list for a while. Have you seen the movie Snowpiercer?
I have not, but I'll bet you I know what it's about.
What do you think it's about?
It's about piercing snow, obviously.
You're not wrong. You're not. Technically wrong, but it is about so much more. So Snowpiercer is a movie about a train, and it's basically the last train on Earth. And it was
the last train on Earth?
For all intents and purposes, the Earth has become a glacierized Iceland, like the what is that called? The Ice Age has fallen upon us again.
Ice Age has fallen upon us.
And so the only way to survive is this train must keep moving through around and around and around and so it's a moving train, and it's a sci-fi setup. So it's kind of one of those things where you have to like Okay. This is true. Let's move on.
Okay.
And but the train is also a metaphor for the class system. So like the back of the train are the poors and the front of the train are the riches, and the poors basically do all the work to let the riches live. And so it stars Chris Evans as the hero, I guess, of this story. Interestingly enough, it's a Korean film. It's
really?
An English language film, but it's a Korean film, and it was directed by Bong Joon-ho, who is known more recently for the movie Parasite,
okay.
which got a lot of attention a few years ago. Did you ever see Parasite?
Nah.
Okay, it's on my list.
Okay.
It's on my list for a different reason.
Okay.
But I want you to see... I remember liking Snowpiercer. It's been a long time since I've seen it. It's a... Oh, 2013.
Wow.
So it's been a while since I've seen it.
Okay. All right.
So
Snowpiercer. Yeah, all right. Cool. Well, hey, Travis, I really appreciate hearing your opinions today. If you, the listener, want to send us your opinion, you can do so by emailing us at exposingourselvespodcast@gmail.com or drop in your thoughts into our Facebook page. Just search Exposing Ourselves.
Yeah, please do that. And also do us a favor, if you're this far into the podcast and still listening, go down into your podcast player of choice and leave us a rating and a review if you care to leave a couple sentences about what you think about the show.
Yeah.
And yeah, Matt, thank you for exposing yourself to me.
Well, you're welcome, Travis. Thank you for exposing yourself to me.